Are you tense, anxious, worried, always tired but can't fall asleep? Are you afraid you're losing your grip?
Who was it said that we begin to grow wise when we learn not to chase too hard the things we prize?
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael. And if you're dreaming about a life without strain, this episode is for you. Our guest today joins us for a chat about institutional enemy theory, the American dream, and cybercrime. Dr. Thomas Dearden is an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Tech, where he looks into tech-related and white-collar crime. Along with colleagues, he recently authored a paper related to strain and cybercrime, which is great for us because we get to circle back to cover something that we stepped over in our mini-series on cybercrime theory. So I called Dr. Dearden on Zoom to have a chat about this research, and pretty quickly I became aware of two things. Firstly, he seems to be a great guy and very helpful. Secondly, he's missing part of an ear. Now normally, it's polite not to inquire, but my curiosity got the better of me. Was it the result of a bear attack, due to accidentally answering an iron instead of the telephone, or perhaps a bottle in a bar fight on the bad side of town? So I gently, politely, delicately inquired, "What happened to your ear?"
Yeah, so my ear went through surgery and didn't make it by design. So I had a melanoma. A pretty rare form of melanoma, actually, that confounded the doctors for a little while until they put it under the microscope. And then they came back panic-stricken and said, you should probably get this off real quick. So I had most of my ear taken off, and now it's a C instead of an O, which is exciting. I now have a C and an O. Which works out because those are the letters my children's names start with. So they think it was by design.
So did you ever call your kids Lefty and Righty?
No, I'm not good enough with left and right to remember that. I think I would confuse myself more than them. I have to still do the L and the R on my hands, hold up my hands to figure out what's left and right. And it's confusing because it changes based off of your own direction.
It's not fair. Last year we did a series on theory, and we did quite a few, but we didn't touch at all on any of the strain theories. And I felt like we missed something, but it's a good chance to circle back because you've recently authored a paper sort of based around strain theory. The paper is Institutional Enemy Theory and Cybercrime, Cybercrime and the American Dream, now available online, which you wrote with some of your colleagues. And it's a nice paper, but it gives me a good chance to ask you about strain theory. Can you explain to me a little bit about the background, the history of that?
Strain theory really has its roots in, ironically, strain. And in this way, strain is all about the life experiences and the difficulties that someone has been through and how that can affect really the outcomes and how that can affect crime. So I think that's kind of the very broad overview of strain theory. And there is certainly numerous authors that we could talk about, as well as kind of maybe divergent notions of strain. But to get more at the roots, I think we have to go to our kind of classic sociologists. Certainly can't forget Durkheim. This way here would be kind of a good middle of the road starting point here for strain.
And I think that marks a turning point in the podcast, but I think that's the first time we've mentioned Durkheim by name, but necessary in this case.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because I think Durkheim might be on every graduate student's reading list, and they usually bemoan that when they get to it and say, wow, this is dense stuff.
What would be classified as strain? Is it stress or is it something else or a broader concept?
I think there are numerous kind of turning points for strain theories, but in many measures, we're going to see a pretty drastic life events. Things like your parents divorced when you were a kid, you experience some traumatic event, often victimization is going to be included in a strain. Some of those big events that are generally traumatic are going to be our kind of classic strains.
Being put under these kind of pressures, it pushes you towards crime, or does it change your sort of response to particular decision-making scenarios?
Well, I think the sociologist would largely say the first, and that is that this, depending on how it's kind of looked at, is going to be kind of a big structural change. In environmental conditions, we can even go back to look at some of the geographical effects, even things like the Burgess model, which is, I think, certainly outdated at this point, but really looks at those concentrated disadvantages and things that affect an environment and affect a location. I imagine if we gave this theory to a psychologist, they would absolutely say, hey, this is going to change how you think about a problem, right? This is going to change how you approach your life and decision making.
One development of strain theory is the idea of the American dream and how that idea of strain combines with the American dream.
Yeah, I really like the institutional anomie theory approach to strain. It is kind of a specific model of strain that looks at largely developed capitalist societies that really promote financial gain above all else. And then says, in that environment, what are the strains that we're going to see? And those strains are really going to relate to financial pressures. They're going to relate to defining money as success and limiting all other forms of success. So I really thought that notion was interesting, as I was kind of thinking of some of the old hacking manifesto and so forth, where you see that kind of countercultural norm, the complaint against this model. And so it seems to me that the hackers themselves were kind of recognizing this system and they were complaining against the system. And so I thought, well, hey, if the hackers are recognizing and complaining against it, maybe there's going to be something about it in our cybercrime world where we see alternate markets. We see drug markets that are ways to achieve financial success that are outside of our culturally approved methods.
You're going to have to excuse some ignorance here. Could you explain to me what the American dream is? Because my dream is constant availability of a hot bath and a good meal.
No, it's fascinating. I ask my students this question and I never get a consistent answer. I think that when we think of the kind of the classic American dream, this is going to be that really prototypical movie portrayal, the two-car garage, the white picket fence, the suburb grass, the family with 2 to 3 kids, and maybe even the one working family. And it's going to be that self-made model, the one where, regardless of where you started from, if you just work hard enough, you can achieve this success. I think it absolutely includes a hot bath, and it includes that meal aspect. My students frequently will say different things. They will say that it is all about the next step, the chance that, hey, no matter where you are, you have the opportunity to go to the next level. And that next level could be out of abject poverty, or it could be from $1 million mansion to another.
Is that sort of based on a foundation of society being a meritocracy and money being the measure of one's merit?
I think so. I think that there are certainly some written aspects, but at least for institutional anomie theory, I think it's the unwritten aspects that are pretty valuable in this discussion. And the whole idea that success is earned, success is achievable by anybody, really allows for that almost caste-like structure where it is, if you're wealthy, you deserve that, and probably you're a decent person. Whereas if you're not, then it's really on yourself. It's you didn't work hard enough. You didn't do those things that were necessary to achieve the American dream.
It's interesting that you say that if you've made money and you're wealthy, then you're probably a decent person. Because I guess that creates some kind of conflict if you have managed to make money by indecent means. There's a competition then between the understanding that the wealthy are decent by judgment of being wealthy and the indecent means or illegal means of attaining wealth.
Yeah, it creates this really interesting dichotomy in people's heads. And as someone that has spent a lot of my academic career on very traditional white-collar crime, it's interesting to see the commentary from even the victims themselves. And there was a case that I was reading about the other day that was a swindle, a very basic swindle. Said, hey, I will invest your money, you'll get a great return, and was a complete fraud. And the victims came back and said, this can't be a fraud. You know, he was too nice. He's too good of a person. The government's wrong. We'll get our money back. And it was really a hard thing for them to accept that this wealthy, nice person was a fraudster, was a criminal.
That's really interesting, because I've only really thought about the idea from sort of the opposite perspective, that somebody must be a good person because they've done well. And for better or for worse, it usually makes me think of characters like Jay-Z, who professes a criminal past and having gotten started through illegal means, but now being a successful musician and a successful ambassador for America through his music and through the other works that he does. I've never thought of it the other way around, that somebody, because of appearing like a nice person, therefore couldn't be immoral or criminal.
Yeah. And this is what I think gets us in trouble in all sorts of ways, that allows criminals to hide for a long time. You know, we can talk about white collar crime all day with, you know, the Madoffs, who was really able to orchestrate a Ponzi scheme for far longer than a Ponzi scheme should ever be able to exist. But even individuals like Larry Nassar, who was the gymnast coach, who was really a sexual predator, he got away with it for so long because I think people had trouble seeing past the niceness, seeing past what great volunteer work that he did. He just didn't seem like the normal portrayal of a criminal.
So an aspect of this is in some way that the American dream as an institutional ideal and the structures surrounding it, it creates pressure for people to more seriously consider illegal ways of satisfying that dream.
Absolutely. And I will add kind of one element there, and that is that it creates the pressure. And if you don't have the opportunity, then I think you will look for other, maybe illegal, opportunities to achieve financial success.
That brings us to cybercrime and the eternal opportunity that's associated with cybercrime. How is it applying that theory to cybercrime as a way of achieving that outcome?
You know, for this, I think the best case study is Ross Ulbricht, who was our Silk Road kind of runner, starter. He ran this very successful drug marketplace for a number of years. And when you looked at him, he was an Eagle Scout. He was a college graduate, really kind of a generally what appeared to be very, very good individual, but was really enamored with notions of free markets. And because of that, he wanted to create a marketplace that was unhindered by government regulations. And at least in his own voice, this was an experiment in free markets and became wildly successful. And so I guess in that way, what we see is the internet, the dark web, offer something that can elude the government, at least for a pretty good segment of time. So it becomes this venue, a potential venue for individuals who maybe don't have legitimate means to find other means, whether that's fraud or whether that's creating something like the Silk Road drug marketplace that Ross Ulbricht created.
That approach where the end of open capitalism justifies the means, where people might do illegal things on a platform like the Silk Road, is that based in a very sort of individualistic or self-centered way of approaching the world or community?
Absolutely. And I think individualism is not only a byproduct of the structures that we have in place, but really kind of aids and assists, or if even increases, the pressure that people have to achieve financially. And this is something that's directly talked about by Messner and Rosenfeld, who authored Institutional Anime Theory, that this kind of rampant individualism, it comes from the American dream, because the American dream is your American dream. It is your success. It is not necessarily family success. It is not society success. It is, if you don't have that white picket fence and that two-car garage, that's on you. And that is what you should strive for. So I think individualism is a great term for it. Absolutely.
In talking about individuals, so the study that you did, it had, was it just over 1,300 individuals that were part of a survey?
Yes. So we used kind of Survey Sample International, which is now Dynata. They changed their name, I think, basically mid-project for us. And as well as Qualtrics, we were looking at kind of the two different big online vendors who do surveys. And we did a kind of a general survey, but we were largely focusing on those who would admit to committing some form of online crime. And we had a series of different examples, everything from revenge porn to uploading copyrighted files, malware. So kind of a wide gamut of cybercrime.
So it was an online survey of people admitting to some kind of cyber criminal behavior or deviant behavior.
Yes. Well, at least the sample that we were using was kind of the subsample of those who did admit. As you would suspect, most people did not admit. And I imagine that's fairly accurate. Most people don't commit cybercrime. But we were working with those who did within that sample.
This introduces perhaps a point of tension for us to negotiate in that, I mean, we've been talking about strain theory, the American dream, and institutional enemy theory as sort of the base for this research. Those are very sort of structural, macro-level type theories and discussions. And your data you've collected from individuals. So how do you go about negotiating that gap between a set of theories that were really designed to operate at a macro level and an application that necessarily is at a more of an individual or micro level?
Yeah. And so I think there's a number of ways that we did this. Probably the simplest answer is we weren't the first. In fact, we borrowed from Muftik's 2006 survey, which really approached a very similar content on cheaters, looking at the individual behaviors using institutional anime type scales. And in addition to that, Messner and Rosenfeld recently, and about, I think it was 2019, had a kind of an update to institutional anime theory. And one of the things they said is, hey, we're seeing some different individual measures of institutional anime theory, and it seems like it's working out just fine. So I think the simple answer is once I saw the kind of stamp of approval by the authors of the theory, I felt pretty comfortable in using it in an individual way. I think my journey was not that simple. My journey, I think, started, of course, in my psychology undergraduate degree, but also kind of working in an individual fashion online, right? Seeing the stories of individuals and how they share. And my mind just saying, hey, that sounds a lot like strain theory. In addition, teaching, you know, many of our sociology majors, that's hard for them to grapple in criminology, that kind of shift to structural levels of thinking. And so sometimes starting with that reductionist notion, saying, hey, here is the structural approach. But you know, if it helps you to think about this until you can kind of get your mind around the structures of it, this can affect individuals too. And I think they personalize it and they see that. So I think all those things wrapped together kind of said, hey, you know, we can look at this from an individual fashion.
What were your independent variables? What were the measures of institutional enemy theory?
We used Muftik scale, and there was a number of different measures there on kind of enemy theory, but it was largely around, you know, how much do you buy into the system? Right? How much do you buy into the notion that if you work hard, you can achieve success? How much would you sacrifice? Right? Would you sacrifice other forms of entertainment, of family life, of whatever, to achieve that success, financial success? One of my favorites, and I don't know if I have a favorite independent measure, that sounds pretty nerdy, but I'll go with it, is the fetishism of money. This whole concept that there's never enough. that you always are going to want more money, and you're always going to be working for that next amount of money. That money becomes the end goal rather than the transaction, right? The economic transaction that it really should be. And so these were all then kind of summated into our IAT scale. And so that was kind of our primary measures there. Of course, we have other demographics in various models to make sure that all of this didn't wash out with other demographics. But those were our independent variables.
You included sort of a measure of computer knowledge. Why did you put that in there as well?
Well, the assumption here is that some of the forms of cybercrime are not easy to commit. It takes at least some knowledge to upload some malware. Now, of course, you could do that accidentally, but I imagine you probably wouldn't confess to it unless you were kind of doing it intentionally. And so we included those just to see, you know, are there kind of specific versions of the crime that require more computer knowledge? That seem to go along with, I kind of want to go here to the, not to bring up other theories necessarily, but our routine activities theory, that, you know, just kind of a question of those who operate online, those who are the ones who are working in this environment, who have that knowledge, is that going to factor in, would be kind of why we included that.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid. I mean, a lot of the papers that I've read with routine activities theory, they generally differentiated opportunities between different types of crime and different levels of technical proficiency. It makes total sense after you've explained it. So what exactly was it that you found? Did it turn out the way you expected it to in terms of results?
Yes. And let me put a kind of a caveat there, that one of the things that I think is novel, aside from looking at this in a cybercrime lens, is we wanted to see as well the shape of institutional enemy theory. I don't think anybody's going to contest this necessarily, but institutional enemy theory has some mixed support. There are numerous studies that find nil results, and there are numerous studies that actually find results. To me, that says that there is some mediator, there is some moderator that is affecting these outcomes. And so one of the things that we thought about was, well, you know, what should this look like? And most human behaviors don't follow the linear trends that we typically associate with regression lines. So we added a squared term, which allowed for kind of a curvilinear approach. And both the non-squared and the squared term were significant, which then required some interpretation. And so we found a U-shape. Which is exactly what we expected. So we expected that they had extremely low levels of institutional enemy theory or extremely high levels of institutional enemy theory that we would see crime. And it's kind of right in the middle where you have the buy-in, where you have the non-criminal aspects. At least in my thought process, it made sense, right? If you have somebody who just does not buy into the system, they've kind of checked out. They don't necessarily follow along with those individual American dream type notions, and they've completely decided against the system, right? Completely countercultural. You certainly could see crime from there. And so that's kind of our low end of the U-shaped. And the same venue, if you buy in too much, right? If it's money over all else, that's where you see many individuals that I think I spend most of the time studying, the individuals who are committing fraud, those individuals who are embezzling, who are committing the very classic, I need more money type crimes. So in that way, it did turn out. We found a U-shape and we were kind of interested in the interpretation there.
Did that computer ability end up having much of an impact? Like, did it turn out the way you expect? The more technically capable you are, the more cybery crimes you do?
Not really. And there's kind of a simple explanation for why not. And that's simply because we're working with a low number of population, working with, you know, self-proclaimed offenders, but also we had lumped those offenses together. And so I imagine if we get to the point where we had enough data that we could look at individual offenses, that we would see some differences. We would see things like malware distribution and traditional hacking would have more computer knowledge versus something like, you know, you're insulting people on social media, which, you know, anybody can do from their phone. So when we lump all those together, we don't really see an outcome. But I would suspect that if we had the numbers, we would see it in individual behaviors.
Sort of based on this, and this is not any of the recommendations that you've made in the paper, what would you suspect would be the difference if that American dream became less of an issue, say in a place with a social safety net or guaranteed housing or a universal wage? And I gather that in the United States, these are somewhat contentious political issues, but let's say it's in another fictitious place in Wakanda that has a different social structural system. If there was a place that the American dream wasn't supported by the institutions, what kind of an impact would you expect that to have on crime as a result of the insights that you gathered from this study?
This may sound maybe a little bit too idealistic, but what I would kind of hope to see is that individuals have opportunities to pursue things besides just money. You know, that we would have more artists, we would have more writers, we would have more, you know, clergy, we would have individuals who were in politics because they were wanted to be in politics, not because they were interested in kind of serving a financial purpose. And so with more options, rather than, hey, I have to achieve financial success at all costs, maybe many of these individuals who are really creative hackers, really creative programmers, it takes a lot of skills and really different levels of thinking to write some of these this malware, that maybe they may have more of an artistic approach. Maybe they would be some kind of great, just fundamental programmers who aren't working on financial outcomes. So in that way, I see more options that it would be able to provide individuals with other options besides just, I've got to make more money.
I hope you're right. I hope it wouldn't just result in more artistic malware.
Maybe it'll just be prettier malware. You know, you get more colors than just the traditional blue or green.
So I love to talk about interdisciplinary stuff on the podcast at every opportunity I get. And the opportunity I've gotten here is that your background is not in criminology. You sort of started out your academic life from the perspective of psychology. Yet this paper, you've definitely put on a criminology hat for this one. How does that sort of background and perspective play into how you see these theories and the way of applying them? Do you see things slightly different than the way you're interpreting that your colleagues are seeing them?
I think so. And I think at the very least, we've talked about one, and that is I'm testing a very sociological theory in an individual way. I tossed around the term reductionism, which I think is kind of a bad word in sociology, right? Taking these sociological theories and applying them to individuals, and in some ways, you know, applying them to oneself as well. Beyond that, though, one of the most interesting theories to me relates to, you know, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and all of their work on heuristics and biases. And as much as we try to distance ourselves from some of the classical rational choice type theories, it's hard to avoid. It's hard to avoid even our routine activities theory work, which is fantastic work occurring in cybercrime, almost assumes a degree of rational choice. And so when I look at these things, I do see that we could benefit from some additions of heuristics and biases to the point that we're not saying, hey, people are rational, because I think all of us agree at this point that people probably are not rational in the way that the classical theorists would have suggested.
Well, yeah, watching the news over the last 18 months with debates about public safety and the intersection between the freedom to not wear a mask and the freedom to catch COVID, I can't say that I would disagree with you on people not being at least a little irrational at times. How is it to have those conversations where you're trying to introduce different perspectives, different sort of windows into how these things could be viewed?
I think it's tough. We have a very rich literature and very rich history. And anytime you kind of rock that boat and add in new elements, it's going to cause some reviewers to say, hey, wait a minute, this is too different, right? This is not what we were talking about. So in some ways, I feel like the reviewers can be tough. At the same time, we are academics and we are trying to push new and novel ways of thinking. And so other times I say reviewers saying, hey, you know, this is interesting. This is not the way that we typically think about these problems. So I think there's kind of a blessing and a curse in that way. And some of it comes down to really being careful what journals I choose, really kind of considering, okay, what is the academic market for this type of thinking and this type of approach. And so that's kind of at least the nuts and bolts of navigating that I've been experiencing over the past few years.
It's interesting to see where the rubber hits the road on that normal science versus innovative science in practice in sort of the modern world, which has dozens and dozens and dozens of journals. With that, I think I'm going to ask you where you're going to go from here. So what are you working on now? What's the stuff that you're trying to choose the best venue for, and where would you like to be researching in the future?
Absolutely. I could probably go on for hours, so I will try to do the Cliff Notes version here of this. But I certainly am kind of continuing the same threads that we've been working on. The survey that we had published in this, done through Dynata and Qualtrics, is something that we'd like to carry forward. We'd like to make it more longitudinal. That will certainly allow us to look at trends and to look at maybe a slightly larger data set, especially for kind of self-proclaimed offenders, so we can get down to those individual behaviors. So that's a big part of my plan. I'm currently working on affinity fraud, kind of working with some other researchers from different institutions outside of sociology, became really interested in particularly why Utah, of all places, was having such a white-collar crime problem. And it appears at least one of the reasons is a specific type of fraud called affinity fraud, where individuals use a shared cultural identity, in this case, kind of a shared church, as a way to get in, a way to have kind of a natural trust. And it appears that that kind of helps targeting and helps victimization there. So we're looking at some of the nuts and bolts of affinity fraud. Long term, I've become really interested in some of the bigger stuff. And this is the tough area, I think, is looking at our real structural forms of crime and our stuff that maybe doesn't show up in your average data set, things like corporate crime, things like, you know, international versions of cybercrime, even cyber espionage. So I really like to get into some of this aspect in the future. Still kind of pondering, as I think all of those researchers are, what kind of data even could exist for something like this. So that's kind of my long-term trajectory there.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to finding out more about affinity fraud. That sounds fascinating. And thanks a lot, and keep doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you again to Dr. Dinan for taking the time, and for the paper, Institutional Enemy Theory and Cybercrime, Cybercrime and the American Dream, now available online. It was published in the Journal of Contemporary Criminal Justice, and you can find all the details about that paper in the show notes, as well as the mini-series on cybercrime theory, which is all over at cybercrimology.com. Also, thank you to Dr. Dinan for telling me about his ear. Skin cancer is no joke. If you do have a new spot on your skin, especially if it's growing, go and get it checked out. This has been Cybercrimology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. If you do have a question or a comment, you can reach me at Cybercrimology on Twitter, or by old-fashioned email at cybercrimology@gmail.com.